Okay, so so welcome back. This is the last week of our seminar on a super personal force. And as I was saying, the title of the seminar comes from a paper by Sabuti called A Super Personal Force. If you're interested in that paper, you can get it off Sabuti's website. I really would recommend it, actually, and we've been basing the material on that paper and reflections from that paper. So, yes, but as I said, each week hopefully stands alone as well, although this week kind of is a continuation of last week as well, for those of you that were here last week. And what we kind of returned to the beginning of last week was... Well, in a way, the sort of central paradox, if you like, about Buddhism, but kind of about life, about kind of any fully lived spiritual life. So Buddhism teaches that there is a reality beyond our sort of egoistic will, that there's more to life than just our egoistic will with all its selfish desires and so on. There is life beyond self-clinging. But it's hard to access that. And it's hard is because, yeah, there is this kind of central paradox of basically we're trying to overcome our egoistic will, even our selfish will, you could say, with our egoistic will, because that's kind of all we've got. So how can we do that? Yeah, and in a way, that's what Sabuti's paper is directly addressing. In a way, that's what the whole of the Dharma is trying to address in one way or the other. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to use as a basis for the discussion a chapter from this book. So this book, I've used this before in this class, it's called The Inconceivable Emancipation, and it's a commentary by Sangharakshita on a Mahayana sutta called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. So all you need to know about that for the moment is that the Mahayana is a phase in Buddhism that came a number of years after the time where the Buddha actually lived. So you've got the teachings of early Buddhism, which are talking about the Buddha as a historical character who, you know, was born a human being, walked about India and taught and so on. And then you've got a later phase, which is called the Mahayana or Great Way. And in the teachings of the Mahayana, the Buddha appears as an archetypal figure. So that's kind of all. There's a lot more you could know about it, but that'll be enough, I think, to know about it. So I'm going to use one chapter from this commentary by Sangharakshita, and it's called Building the Buddha Land. And I'm hoping that, this will help to sort of illuminate this central problem of how we get beyond our egoistic will with our egoistic will. So this is called Building the Buddha Land. So what I'll do is I'll just talk for a bit and then there'll be a chance to have questions or discussion. So what the Mahayana teachings call a Buddha Land, they say a Buddha Land is the sphere of influence of one particular Buddha. So, well, that already says quite a lot. So there's more than one Buddha. So the Buddha is not just an enlightened being, so there can be many enlightened beings, but a Buddha is the first to discover the truth of the Dharma in a sort of world sphere or universe. So that's the sort of cosmic vision of the Mahayana. So the Mahayana is taken for granted that there's more than one universe, so it's a sort of multiverse thing, and that there's more than one Buddha. But the sort of main important thing to sort of know from this is that there could be a universe that didn't have a Buddha appearing in it at all. Yeah, so not all universes would be fortunate enough to have a Buddha influencing that universe. Yeah. But our universe, we have got a historical Buddha who we can know about and learn about and so on. So that means that our universe is under the influence of the Buddha, our Buddha, as it were, Shakyamuni. Of course, we know the Buddha isn't some sort of god, isn't it? The Buddha's created the universe. It's just that there has been a Buddha appear in this universe. So we're under the influence of the Buddha, Shakyamuni. And the other thing that the Mahayana teachings do is they distinguish between two kinds of Buddha land. They say you've got pure Buddha lands and impure Buddha lands. So in impure Buddha lands, it's difficult to hear the Dharma. It's difficult to even come across the teachings of the Buddha. It's a place where conditions aren't particularly conducive to spiritual development, where it's difficult for beings to evolve towards enlightenment. And then a pure Buddha land's the opposite. In a pure Buddha land, the conditions are completely and perfectly conducive to spiritual development. So what kind of Buddha land do you think we live in? Any guesses?
Impure,
it's a bit hard for us, isn't it? Yeah, so we're in an impure Buddha land, and that's all it means. So sometimes that word purity kind of bit sort of moral connotations, but it just means it's hard for us. Yeah, it's a struggle for us to even hear the Dharma. I mean, traditionally it'd be said even the fact that we have heard the teachings of the Buddha is really, really fortunate, you know, because like hundreds of people, thousands and millions of people in the world won't have access to, well, not just the Buddhist teachings, in a way, any sort of sense of potential. For many beings in the world, life is just, you know, life's a struggle, life's kind of beset by hardship, both outer, like, kind of wars and famines, and inner kind of torment that would make it very, very hard to, you know, to find and access any sort of sense of a higher kind of realm of existence. So yeah, so we're in this impure Buddha land. But the crucial thing is that that distinction isn't absolute. There's a sort of, it's not that an impure Buddha land just stays that forever. You know, there's a fluidity between these two. So that this is, well, lucky for us in a way. Because if we're thinking of building the Buddha land, well, yeah, we couldn't do that if there wasn't that possibility of movement. And then, interestingly enough, sometimes a Buddha land's also known as a Buddha field. So it's nice, you've got that, with the image of a field, where you've got that, well, very kind of sort of powerful metaphor, really. You know, field being something that seeds are planted, that sort of that growth is possible. So you've got a sort of suggestion that the living beings in that Buddha field, you know, we can cultivate ourselves. We have got the potential for growth and development. And you get that, you know, you get that kind of notion repeated again and again in the Mahayana scriptures. They'll talk about living beings kind of maturing and ripening and growing. And even in early Buddhism, you've got the same sort of imagery of growth. You've got, when the Buddha was just newly enlightened, it said he had a vision of humanity. He looked out and saw humanity like lotuses, and some were just still completely in the mud, just kind of barely formed buds, and some were kind of more fully formed buds, and then some were complete flowers standing out of the water. And that was an image for beings in different stages of development. And then again, in another sutra, you've got the Buddha compared to the sun shining down on all beings. And And well, actually, and this one is actually rain. It's like the rain raining down on all beings, and you've got this sort of lovely notion of all beings being like plants, all growing in their own way. So I really like that, because it sort of shows, well, the individuality, you know, like a tree is going to grow like a tree, a little daisy is going to grow like a daisy, etc. You know, so again, the implication of, you know, you've got this one teaching of the Dharma raining down, but every being will grow and flourish in their own way to become more complete as the, you know, more tree-like if you're a tree, or more rose-like if you're a rose, as it were. So the building and purifying of the Buddha land is the main theme of the first chapter of this text called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. Vimalakirti Nirdesha means that the teachings of Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti is a bodhisattva, a being who is bent on enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Very interesting character to read about. But anyway, so this, the chapter, the scene is set in a garden which has been donated to the Buddha and his disciples. And the text tells us that the Buddha's staying in this garden with a great gathering of disciples. So for a start, there's 8,000 monks, so they would all be in their yellow robes, shaven-headed, begging bowls and so on. And they've all gained enlightenment, so they're all enlightened monks. And they're often represented in Buddhist art. You can see this if you've seen the picture downstairs in our downstairs shrine room, as, well, very definitely human figures, often kind of quite old and wrinkled, bowed down with age, maybe with a stick. So there's a sense of these are beings who have, they have struggled, you know, they've won enlightenment, but it's been a struggle. So there's 8,000 of them in this garden, ready to hear the Buddha. And there's also 32,000 bodhisattvas. And so this is, so now that immediately moves us into the realm of archetypes. So the bodhisattvas are traditionally depicted as beautiful youths, princes and princesses, in the prime of life, adorned with jewels, and yeah, just kind of, you know, in a way eternally youthful. And again, if you've seen our painting downstairs, you'll see the Buddha on one side, he's got the arahants, and then he's on the other side, he's got the bodhisattvas, and you can see the contrast, yeah? So there's the arahants, there's the bodhisattvas, and there's also all these gods and goddesses and mythological beings, as well as ordinary monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen. And they're all around the Buddha, and they're waiting for him to teach the Dharma. But before the Buddha gets started, another bodhisattva comes along from a place called Vaishali, and he's accompanied by 500 Lichavi youths. Yeah, Lichavi means that's the people who come from Vaishali. And each of them's carrying a parasol, and each parasol is made of the seven precious substances, and these are gold, silver, pearl, sapphire, ruby, emerald and diamond. So these very fantastic parasols. And they come and they bow to the Buddha, and then they circumambulate him seven times. And then they offer him their parasols. And then, so remember, we're in the realm of myth and archetype here, so rather than the realm of literal truth, we're in the realm of archetypal truth. These are all offered to the Buddha, these 500, and the Buddha transforms them into one huge canopy. He makes a sort of magical display, in a way, and he transforms them into one single precious canopy, and it says, so enormous that it covers the entire billion world galaxy. And not only that, the contents of the billion world galaxy are all reflected in the interior of the canopy. So all those present can look up into it
and see limitless suns, moon, stars, heavenly realms, mountains, oceans, rivers, limitless people and limitless Buddhas teaching the Dharma. So you're definitely, yeah, most definitely in the realm of myth and archetype and splendour. And you can hear all these Buddhas, you can distinctly hear their voices in the canopy. And so naturally the whole assembly is like totally amazed by this display. Yeah? So what does this mean? We'll have a few suggestions. So first of all, you've got these youths all bringing their 500 parasols. What do you think that might symbolise? These youths coming to the Buddha with these 500 parasols.
Questions?
Yeah. Okay, so what were you thinking?
They're bringing sort of questions
then. Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. And so what, say, that's interesting. So what sort of attitude do you think they had to the Buddha, like bringing these?
A ceremony gift.
I think it's as sort of simple as that, really, that they're coming there, like this is they see the Buddha and that's their aspiration, and they want to give something very, very precious to represent, you know, that they too want to, you know, here's the Buddha who's gained enlightenment for the sake of all beings, and they're saying, oh, that's what we aspire to. So they offer something that's the most precious. I mean, it's described in a way that you could hardly get anything more precious. And, you know, so that's a bit, in a sense, it's a bit like us. If we bow before the shrine, that's what we're doing. We're saying, or if we offer a stick of incense, it doesn't seem very precious, but in a way it's kind of compared to these. But in a sense, it's precious in that we're saying, if we did have all these diamonds and things, we'd offer them as well, you know, because... Yeah, that's our aspiration, yeah. And the Buddha is representing that. So it's a sort of trying to, it's a movement towards that. So what do you think it might mean that all the parasols then are turned into this gigantic canopy? Does that sort of speak to you in any way? I know it's all a bit fantastical, but...
That we're one.
Hmm?
That we're one.
Okay.
That unifies us, in a way.
Uh-huh, so they're unified in some... So what's the unifying factor?
Of a separate youth who brought something.
Uh-huh.
And gave gratitude.
Yeah.
He took that gratitude and sort of made it, like, we're one, I don't know, unified everyone and the universe and God.
Yeah, I think it is something like that. It's that, it's like the aspirate, it's the same aspirate. So they all come with the same aspiration, yeah? So they're, in a way, they're individual people, but then there's this shared aspiration, yeah? And that's a unifying force. So the shared aspiration is a unifying force. So it's, you could say that the people are individual, but the aspiration kind of converges and even sort of unites to become a single force, and in a sense it's all because it's all been given to the Buddha. So the Buddha's sort of higher than them, and it's, well, I see it's sort of drawing all this together. Yeah. So that's a unifying force. And again, it's a bit like when we say we salute the shrine before we meditate. Like, we're doing that kind of collectively, but together. So we're trying to unify within ourselves and sort of integrate within ourselves all our aspiration. And then also we're doing that together, so it has, well, sort of greater power by the fact we're doing it together. Any comments on that?
seems like there's something protective about the image of the parasol.
Oh, yeah,
well.
Yeah.
It's not just any old jewelled gift.
Yeah.
It's something that protects you from
from
the kind of the birth, the heat of the sun. So they have this thing which turns into a canopy which kind of encompasses the whole universe.
Yeah.
It's kind of, but then they're able to see the universe kind of reflected in it. They're protected from the kind of hard rays of the sun, but then they're able, through that protection, they're able to see this expanse of cosmos. So it's kind of, I know that seems to refer to kind of the dual nature of the Dharma, which is that one's kind of refuge and the other, it kind of allows you to see things as they really are, which is kind of contradictory.
Yeah.
But
that's lovely, isn't it? And again, it reminds me of what some of those Greek myths were, you know, people ask to see the gods, and the god says, no, don't ask me, you know. Mm. And they ask again, the god says, no, don't ask me. And then, because they ask three times, the god shows themselves, and it just burns them up, because it's too much being seen directly. So something about the canopy and the reflection, maybe that's all we can bear at first. So almost we need the protection of the canopy to see the reflection, first of all, So let's explore this kind of individual and unifying a bit more, because I think there's possibly more to this than meets the eye. So Bhante Sangharakshita is saying, well, so what is this single aspiration? And also, so you could say the single aspiration is to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings and be responsive to the needs of all beings. But Bhante says something that seems to contradict himself. He says it's not collective, So even though it's all turned onto this one parasol, it's not collective. He says at the same time it's not individual in the ordinary sense. So why do you think he's saying it's not collective?
Because everyone went on their own.
Uh-huh.
They go together.
Say that again, so...
Everyone went to him individually. They didn't go together.
Yeah.
He's the one that made them collective.
Yeah, yeah. So it's something, I think that's it, isn't it? That people, so it's not collective in the sort of lowest common denominator sense. It's not a kind of group mentality of like, oh, go on, I'll give my parasol if you give yours, sort of thing. You know how sometimes we can, that's almost the kind of, there can be a lower form of collective where we're just doing what everyone else does. And sometimes that can be positive on its own level. But there's something that has got to be an individual. Why has it got to be individual? Why have the offerings got to be individual? What's important about that?
So we're all unique and we have different things to offer.
Say that a little bit louder.
We're all unique, yeah. And in a sense, we all have a slightly different path. Reach the end, but we will take a different path.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. So we are all unique, and it will express itself in different ways. Yeah. Good.
If we're all aspiring towards enlightenment, but only our own efforts, we have to work on ourselves. To reach that enlightenment.
Yeah, I think that's what it's getting at as well. We're all unique. We have to do it. So it's like nobody can do it for us, actually. Which again sounds, it's easy to say, but I think sometimes we can, I think it's got a lot of implications, this, that our spiritual life has to be an individual act. People can neither do it for us, or at the same time, they can't undo it for us as well. I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking, th- there's quite a lot of implications in that, because it means we've got to be proactive all the time. We're supported by other people, and that's definitely true, but we can't sort of lean on other people in the sense of expecting them to do it for us. And at the same time, if we really were truly individually going for refuge to the Buddha, then no matter what other people did in the Sangha, they couldn't take that away from us either. So it would mean that even if somebody in the Sangha did something that we didn't like or approve of, or even, you know, was actually unskillful, it wouldn't take away from our going for refuge. So it's got, there's kind of both sides to it. So it's got quite a lot of implications. And that's reflected in in a number of the rituals that we have, especially rituals of commitment in our movement and order. So for example, when someone becomes a mitra, that I know some of you have and some of you are thinking about, we have a very simple little ceremony where you're witnessed in making the three traditional offerings. But it's very significant that people do that on their own, that people come forward one at a time to do that. And that represents that you're doing it of your own accord. You know, you're doing it. You might be inspired by the fact your friends are doing it and even encouraged by them. But at the end of the day, you're still doing it for yourself. So, I don't know, even if at the last minute your friends suddenly changed their mind, you would still do it. Yeah, so it's got that. So it's got that saying. Same with ordination. There's this idea of even if no one in the world was going to get ordained, you would still do it. But at the same time, you're really glad to discover that other people have done it, because there is the importance of Sangha. So you've got this, you've got the... So it's not collective in the kind of lowest common denominator sense. At the same time, it's not individual in the ordinary sense. And Sangharaksha says it belongs to a mysterious category that we haven't got a word for in the English language. And apparently there is a word called something like sobernost in Russian that apparently is the closest to it, which means something like a third order of consciousness. It means something like a collection of people who are all individually spiritually practicing. It's what happens when a number of people who have made that individual offering of a parasol, say, in other words, individual aspiration, of when a number of them have come together, you get something that's more than the sum of the parts. Yeah, you get something that's this third order of consciousness, and which we probably all felt. We talked about this last week. We probably all felt that when a number of us have come together, saluted the shrine and meditated, we get something that's not any of us individually, but that's more than us individually, but that couldn't happen without us. Yeah. So that's what this offering of the parasols and turning into the canopy, you know, that's a way we could read that. And the more that our spiritual aspirations have a common object, so for Buddhists that would be aspiring to Buddhahood ourselves, then the more they'll be united. And then the more they're united, and this is the important bit, then the more there can be a force for good in the world. So, you know, that united effort is much, much more than any single person's ever could be. In every way, it's more in volume, isn't it? But it's more in richness because of things people have been saying. If we're all bringing our own uniqueness to that, we can create something that's much, much more. Okay, so... So these, just going back to the story, there's another little bit of it. So they all make their offerings, all these youths, and then there's sort of head person, there's a bodhisattva already, wants to know, well, how can we build a Buddha land? And the Buddha apparently is quite pleased with this question. And he answers at some length, so I won't tell you everything the Buddha says, but he says, noble sons, he says, a Buddha field is a field of living beings. And he says, why is that? And he says, that's because a Buddha field springs from the aims of living beings. So this is, again, this is important, that it's not anything other than living beings, yeah? So a bodhisattva, or a being sort of bent on enlightenment, is their kind of mission, you could say, is to build a Buddha land. But the only thing they've got to build a Buddha land with is living beings. But how are they going to do that? Because you can't just get people and go, right, come on, I'm going to build a Buddha land out of you, in a way. You can't, even a Buddha, even a bodhisattva, can't kind of create a Buddha land and keep people in a Buddha land if people don't want to be there, yeah? Well, I mean, that might sound obvious, but why can't a Buddha or a bodhisattva do that? Why can't you make people be in a Buddha land kind of against their will, as it were?
It's all like individual intention.
Uh-huh. So say a lot more.
It's all individual intention.
So say all individual intention and say a little bit more about...
So it's whatever people's are thinking and their actions and... Uh-huh. Which you can't control.
Yeah, and what would happen, just to take it a little bit further, what would, say you try to control it?
Rebellion.
Hmm?
Rebellion,
yeah, people would rebel, and would they be right to rebel? What do people think?
Yeah.
Yeah, who said yeah? Yeah? Who said yeah? John? Yeah, you. So come on, why would they be right to rebel?
Well, it just connects with what we were saying.
Yeah.
It has to be, you have to want to
yeah.
do that favour for somebody or make that offering. Yeah.
I mean, again, we might be stating the obvious, but I think it's worth saying because sometimes we do try and control people, don't we? I certainly do. But actually, if anybody tries to control anyone else, even if you sort of think you're doing it for good motives, actually, you can't. It's a contradiction in terms. Yeah, you can't. Like the spiritual life, I think, as we're saying, but it's worth sort of saying. Like has got to be a free life, yeah. It's got to be an autonomous life, or else it isn't a spiritual life anymore. I mean, there's a lovely saying of Sangharaja's that I kind of quote again and again. He says you have to be free not to be a Buddhist to be a Buddhist, and I think there's so much in that. Yes, go on.
The point that I was going to make is that I know it's an individual, it's a personal thing,
yeah.
but we're influenced by other people.
Yes.
Other people may show us the way.
Yes, they may show us the way. I think that's a good point. But we have to freely take up that way.
We take the choice.
Yeah,
we decide whether we're going to do it. But the point is that other people may well show us the way.
Yeah, yeah. And it's essential in a way for most of us, well, all of us up until enlightenment, that we do have people showing us the way. So they can. So then you've got an interesting... You're sort of treading a line, aren't you, between... allowing yourself to be shown the way, but doing that as an autonomous individual. So you don't. It's easy to fall into extremes. So one extreme is nobody's going to tell me anything. Yeah. So that's one extreme. If you fall into that, you're never going to learn. The other extreme is you just kind of you just do anything anybody tells you. So you fall into a sort of gullibility. But is that the spiritual life? Well, no, it's not. And it's very interesting. You've even got the Buddha in some early suttas sort of chastising his disciples for both extremes, you know. So he's got one person that always just wants to argue all the time and never listens, and he says, the Buddha takes him to task and says, well, you're not really being a disciple of mine by doing that. But you've got another disciple who just kind of learns the teachings all off by heart and never thinks about them, and the Buddha also chastises him and says, actually, that's not being my disciple. You've got to think about it and keep the initiative, but and sort of follow. Yeah, so it's got to, the Buddhist life's got to be a free life. So I think it's worth sort of spelling that out. And again, we can keep coming back to that and keep on asking ourselves at that every step of the way. And you can use that phrase in different ways to yourself. You know, you've got to be free not to be a Buddhist, to be a Buddhist. Again, we mentioned that some people have become mitras here and some people are thinking of becoming mitras. But actually, nobody has to do that. You know, you can come to this centre and not be a mitra, for example. Mitra means a mitra is when you decide you want to sort of align yourself with Buddhism and align yourself with the Tri Ratna community, and you're a very positive step to take, but and you're free not to take it, you know? And that's an important principle, that we're delighted when someone does take that step, we being, you know, the order here, but also if someone decides not to, that's great too, you know, in a sense, because there's got to be that autonomy and freedom. So I always think that's quite a good question to ask yourself along the way in your spiritual life. Just remind yourself, oh, I'm free. Not only I am free, but I have to be free not to take that step in order to take it. Yeah. So here's the Bodhisattva. I'm trying to build a Buddha land, and what's he going to do? Because he can't sort of make people do it. And so the answer is that this Buddha land has to be a joint creation, yeah? It has to be built by a number of people working together. And it might be that one or some of these people are more advanced, as it were, than others, a bit like Diabhadra was alluding to. So one or more might have more vision, might even be the first to attain enlightenment, and then are helping others along the way. But in a sense, everybody's moving in the same direction. The important thing is that everybody would need to be inspired by the same ideal. And for Buddhists, that ideal would be the ideal of enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So it has to be something that we're working on together. But you could even take it. You could even take the question a step back, which is, so why does the Bodhisattva want to build this Buddha land in the first place? Yeah. So in the lecture, Bhante says, well, you could say, you know, you could take the classic answer and say, well, the Bodhisattva wants to build the Buddha land or the Buddha field to help others by providing the ideal environment to develop spiritually. But he says, well, that raises even a further question of, well, why should the Bodhisattva be concerned with others at all? So there's a question. So why is a Bodhisattva somebody who's aspiring to attain enlightenment? Well, why don't they just get on with it for themselves? Why should a Bodhisattva be concerned with others at all?
I have a question for this. I remember I was reading an excerpt from this letter.
Yeah.
It was basically talking about how, like, everybody, you know, needs to take their time, like, you know, through the various lifetimes, people are eventually going to come to the point when they're going to eventually reach enlightenment. So everybody needs to take their time. But then, how does influence come in, like, in this point? Because it's kind of like you'd always kind of want to influence other people, mm-hmm. to sort of help people out so that, you know, for example, you would sort of say, introduce somebody into Buddhism and then, or maybe like get somebody else to become a vegan, you know, something like that. But then everybody's going to be, if everybody's going to be reaching there anyways, then what's the whole...
Okay, well, actually, I don't know what book you were reading, but everybody's got the potential to enlightenment, but enlightenment certainly not guaranteed. You know, so it's not that everyone will definitely attain enlightenment. It's not just a matter of time that everyone will. So that's one thing. And the other thing was, well, that influences the very thing we're talking about. So for example, you know, we can't make someone a vegan, for example. We might think it's a brilliant thing to be vegan. We might totally believe it, but, you know, well, you know, we can't... That it's still got to be that person's choice, but we can still act in ways that might inspire them. But that's going to take skill, because, well, probably everybody's had the experience of someone trying to convince them to do something. I remember one friend of mine who was passionate about environmental issues always used to try and convince me to not use so many carrier bags. But I have to confess, her manner of going about it used to make me so reactive. I'm ashamed to confess this, but I feel like I'd end up feeling I'd take even more carrier bags than I would have. You know, and we've probably all been on... So you need to be very skillful to influence, yeah? Because, well, that's what we've just been seeing. You can't make somebody do something. And actually, if you try to, you sometimes have the opposite effect. But let's go back to our original question. So here you've got the Bodhisattva. We're saying the Bodhisattva is trying to build this Buddha field of beings. But why are they even trying to do that in the first place? Why should someone who's trying to attain enlightenment be concerned with others at all? Why not, you know, why not just kind of go for it yourself? Why bother about other people? Maybe somebody who hasn't... Yes, Al, go on.
Well, from what I can gather, like, if you're moving towards enlightenment, there isn't a self.
Okay.
There isn't a yourself, to say. And it's something like... So I've got my various preferences, my likes and dislikes.
Yeah.
And that extends to the people around me in my life. So I have a preference of the, you know, 8 million people in London for a small selection of my personal family and my personal friends... People who I take to, who I meet in the street, and people who I'm not that bothered about because I've got my personal preferences. But from what I understand, like, if I could expand my kind of my compassion a bit, not just a little bit wider, but kind of infinitely wider, that I wouldn't have. For example, imagine, you know, you're in a dangerous situation and you can save yourself, but you have to leave your loved ones behind. Well, that's what it is. You can leave a painful situation, being samsara, but you're forced to leave your loved ones behind, and your loved ones extend out infinitely.
Yeah.
So, if I found myself in a situation like that, I wouldn't be able to leave. I couldn't, in all good conscience, leave and feel happy about that, unless I could take my family or my loved ones with me.
Mm.
And if I can't take my loved ones with me, I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stay where I am and try to get us all out. And that's the only reason I'm going to go.
For example,
everyone in this room, like for the different paths I've taken in my life, I may or may not have potential strong, intimate, close, lifelong friendships that haven't developed as I've taken different paths. That doesn't mean nobody here who I don't know yet very well doesn't have that potential to be somebody I would really like.
So I think that's having summarised what you said, I think that's it, that you just as that we can imagine, so we've got ourselves, and then most of us will extend that sense of self a little bit to our family and loved ones, and that who can be as dear to us as ourselves. But eventually, the aspiration is all beings would be as dear to. So it wouldn't make sense to talk about just me, because me would now include more and more beings, and for and by at the point of enlightenment it would include all beings, so the whole notion of myself and other beings would break down. Yeah? And that's why maybe I can maybe tie that in with that little exercise we did earlier, which I don't know how you got on with that, but my sense is, again, a similar thing, that if someone you really love asks you to do something and you do it, you start to no longer be able to tell whose will it is anymore. Like, you can't say it's completely their will because you've willingly done it, but you can't say it's completely your will because you've done it because they wanted you to. Do you see what I mean about that? That you can't. Do people get that sense that you've sort of blended the will of the person with the will of your own? Is that? Or maybe people had a different experience.
Sometimes.
Yeah, maybe I have, because it's great to have your questions, but maybe I'll see if I can have someone else as well. Did anyone? Do people know what I mean when I talk about that blending of wills? Or, yeah, you do?
Completely, I do.
Was that other people's experience? Could other people see what I'm getting at when I'm saying that? Or
It can also have a kind of... that's like you've made it sound really good and positive.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you do become very intimate or close to someone, a friend or a partner...
Yeah.
Then you know you can become a kind of double-headed, same person with two heads, or there can be you can start really questioning how individual you are.
Yes, now that's a good distinction, isn't it? Because the blending of oils is again, it's a bit what we're talking about. So there's a kind of unhealthy merging, where you don't know. You've sort of lost, you might have completely lost your sense of self in another. So that's not what I'm talking about, yeah?
Mm.
So that's when you've kind of, I'm calling it go to the lowest common denominator, that's not quite it, but when that's a kind of mentality where you've sort of merged, basically. Maybe that's the best way to put it. So that's different from when you as an individual, completely with the initiative, with that initiative, decide to do something that someone else has asked you to do. Yeah, can people see the difference? So there's one way where you just fall into it. You haven't got awareness. You don't. It's just almost it's a sort of habit. And there's another where you've got the initiative, but you willingly do it. So that's an important distinction. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
You can't be disconnected from yourself.
Yeah, you can't be disconnected from yourself. So let me just check, because I hope I'm speaking in a way that can match. So when I'm talking about that blending of wills in a positive sense, is that resonating with people, or did people have a different? Did people have something of that experience in the little exercise, or not? Not sure.
No, I'm sorry to say that I really struggled to think of a time when somebody asked me to do something.
Oh.
I did it willingly.
Okay.
I did it.
Right. Okay, yeah.
I'm a good guy, but I didn't really... I couldn't think of a time when...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that could happen as well, can't it? Could you imagine... But it sounds like even by being able to say that, you could imagine... Could you imagine... That you didn't have the resentment. I mean, I know the resentment myself.
I can imagine it.
Yeah, or perhaps a smaller thing. There might be a smaller thing that you did willingly.
Probably need a bit of time.
Yeah. Sometimes we put our standards too high. I mean, you know, for example, because I know you, I'm thinking of times you've helped out here at the city. You know, you've done what's needed here at the class. I don't know, would it be too... That you're on the spot to ask you. So why doesn't that qualify? Because this is the nub of it. So why doesn't that qualify?
Well, I guess I did want to do it.
Yeah, because you wanted to do it. So do you see what I mean, how that's the blending of us, how what we needed, your help on the class, and what you wanted to do completely coincided, so it didn't feel like an effort. Yeah, so that's what I'm getting at. Actually, that's brilliant. Yeah, so do people now see what I mean? So it doesn't feel, there's no resentment, there's no nothing, because it's coincided, yeah? So all you need to do is imagine that for a bodhisattva, everything would feel like that, yeah? Which sounds like massive when we think about, but actually you've had a glimpse of that. That would just completely, just as when you helped at the class or whatever it was, it didn't even feel like it qualified. For a bodhisattva, that's what it would feel like. It wouldn't sort of qualify as hardship, because it wouldn't be hardship, because it would just be the natural outpouring, yeah? Wheel. I really want to. It's important to me to. I think this is an important. It's an important point, because it shows that for a bodhisattva, what we might think of as doing good and helping people doesn't feel like doing good and helping people. It might feel like that to them, to the people being helped, but it won't feel like to the bodhisattva, because it just feels like completely natural and spontaneous. There's no alternative, but in a positive way, it's just like, yeah, well, what else would I do? You know, I like that. Yeah, it doesn't qualify as hardship. So that's how a bodhisattva, that's why and how a bodhisattva would build, want to build a Buddha land, yeah? And you do that in cooperation with other people, yeah? It'd be something, in a sense, what you would have in building a Buddha land would be a whole lot of people who are all trying to build a Buddha land together. So it wouldn't be so much that you're building a Buddha land with other people. Actually, everybody would be building the Buddha land with each other, in a sense. It'd be a collective effort, yeah? So maybe we've got just a few minutes. So what has this got to do with us? So I think what this has got to do with us is that, I think if we can just take it down to our level, I think the main thing to realise, and again, what I say might sound obvious, but I don't think often we take this on deeply enough, is to realise more and more deeply that we're not passive in relation to the world, yeah? So generally we experience ourselves as subjects, as it were, in relation to the whole world. So there's me and there's the rest of the world. But actually, it's not that we're just this passive person who registers impressions. The world impinges on us, but we also, you know, we also affect the world, yeah? In all sorts of ways. Sangharaj says we alter it, we arrange it and we rearrange it, at least to some extent. Not only that, he says there's a pattern to the way we do that. We do that, it's not at random, it's in accordance with a certain idea, a pattern, an image or myth within ourselves, even a pattern that is ourselves. So the pattern of me, of you, is affecting the world. And it's we don't always like fully consciously realise this, but what it means is our relationship with the world is essentially creative. Yeah, we're creating all the time. You know, and that's, you know, certainly not limited to what we usually think of as the creative arts. It's you know, we're creative, well, in the art of living itself, Sangharaj just says that. And what we could do is, we'll try and realise that more and more deeply. That all the time we're influencing our environment. I don't even just mean our environment in the way when we talk about environmentalism. I mean, that's a part of it. Then every sense, we help to create the atmosphere
I was at a seminar a few months ago with Maitreya Banda, and he just mentioned something about offhandedly. He said, like, for example, at the Buddhist Center, you hardly ever hear harsh speech and people swearing at the Buddhist Center. And if somebody did do that, it would stand out, wouldn't it? So somehow between us, that's what we've created. It's not, we haven't got a big sign that says, like, no spitting, no swearing. You know, we've never said that, you know. But somehow, we sort of naturally feel like we do that. So sometimes, why I'm saying that, sometimes you can see it more in the smaller situations, that we have an influence, we can create an environment. So here, together, you know, we've created an environment where there's kindly speech present, where there's harmonious speech rather than harsh speech, so that if there ever is harsh speech, it stands out. Whereas there are other environments, the opposite, aren't there, where harsh speech is just the norm, you know, and actually it doesn't stand out. So I think you could say that to create a Buddha land, a Buddha field, that we can just start to notice our own effect on the world, and perhaps notice it in our smaller circles, how we create these small worlds, and we can influence them. We've got more influence than we probably think in terms of the atmospheres we create by things like our speech, by our action. Yeah. So maybe that's something that I see we're kind of at time. The time always seems to go so fast, but something we can just go away and think about. Think about our small environments, maybe our workplace, our home life, our family life or whatever, and just try and see if we can take a little bit more deeply on board that we have an influence on that, that we are a creative force in that, one way or the other, all the time. And what can we do that can create whatever environment we're in into an environment that's a little bit more conducive for people to be able to grow and develop, and to sort of believe that we can have an influence on that, and that we can just start with small steps in that, but it can be quite radical, actually. So I'm going to leave you there. Thanks for coming to the seminar. Thanks for coming tonight. Thanks for coming to the seminar. Next week we're starting a new seminar on the Metta Sutta, and that's going to run for about 5 weeks. The week after we've got a special guest speaker coming. Next week we'll be starting anew. So do come along to that. What's the Metta Sutta?
Oh, sorry.
The Metta Sutta, yeah, next week, yeah. Yeah, so that starts next week. So yeah, thanks for coming along, and hopefully see you next week. Thank you.